Welcome to Chapter 9 of Henry Martin by George Smith. This chapter is entitled In Persia, Bushir and Shiraz, 1811. Now, as we've read this longish book about Martin, I find myself more and more warmed to what we see. We've seen so many ways in which this man has given himself to the gospel, ablaze with love to the Lord Jesus Christ and with a desire to the remarkable number of different kinds of languages and people that he was working amongst. He's just arrived in Persia, where I believe he was going to do his great work before his death at a young age. But this book is heartwarming, it's revealing, it's challenging, and it's a wonderful Christian biography. Of course, the other thing that we read about in each of the chapters is his communication via letter with Lydia Grenfell, a woman whom he would have loved to have married and shared the mission field with, but it seems it was not to be. This story is ongoing, and it's revealing when we read the letters and how both parties in these letters expose what's going on in their hearts. And I expect we'll read more of these letters as we read this chapter. So these are long chapters, but they are rewarding if we invest ourselves in them. So Chapter 9, In Persia, Bushir and Shiraz, 1811. The Persia, to whose 7 millions of people Henry Martin was the first in modern times to carry the good news of God, of course Persia is modern-day Iran, was just the size of the India of his day. The Mohammedan majority of its scattered inhabitants, in cities, in villages, and wandering over its plains and deserts, had never been and are not yet as Shias, rigid members of Islam, fanatically aggressive against all others like the Orthodox Sunnis. After the apparent extinction of the cult of Zoroaster and the flight of the surviving remnant of Parsis to India, the successive ruling dynasties were liberal and tolerant in their treatment of Christians compared with other Muslim powers. More liberal than Christian Russia is to the Jews and the non-Orthodox sects. Of course, this was 2 centuries ago, and there's been a lot of history since then. When those cultured and enterprising brothers, Sir Anthony and Sir Thomas Shirley, went from Oxford to the court of Persia, then in all its magnificence under Shah Abbas the Great, 2 centuries before Henry Martin, that Shah sent one back as Persian envoy to the Christian powers of Europe to establish an alliance for the destruction of the Turks. Shah Abbas made over Gombrun to them, calling it by his own name, Bunder Abbas, which it still retains, and His Majesty's grant used such language as this. And of course, George Smith, who wrote this book, was this biography, was writing about the end of the 19th century, I think. So, our absolute commandment, will and pleasure, is that our countries and dominions shall be from this day open to all Christian people and to their religion. Would that that was true of Persia today. Because of the amity now joined with the princes that profess Christ, I do give this patent for all Christian merchants, etc. Only the intolerance of the Portuguese, who under Albuquerque took the island of Ormuz, sounds like it's something to do with the Straits of Hormuz, which is the world's flashpoint today, and so dominated the Persian Gulf till driven out by the English, led this great Asiatic monarch to accept the power which Prince Henry the Navigator alone redeems from historical contempt to the present day. The Safavian dynasty gave place to the Afghan, and that to the short-lived but widespreading empire of Nadir Kuli Khan from Delhi, to the Oxus River and the Caspian Sea. Out of half a century's bloody revolutions, such as formed the normal course of the annals of Asia, till Great Britain pushed its peace up from the Southern Ocean. Aga Muhammad Khan of the Qajar clan founded the present dynasty in 1795. His still greater nephew succeeded on his death 3 years after. Futteh Ali Shah became for the next 38 years the close friend of the British Crown and the East India Company. Shah in Shah, or King of the Four Kings of Afghanistan, Georgia, Kurdistan and Arabistan, The ruler of Persia had now incorporated Arabistan in his own dominion and had lost Afghanistan. Just sounds almost like what's going on today in some ways. But he still claimed the allegiance of the two subject sovereigns of Georgia and Kurdistan. His uncle had avenged on the people, and especially the beautiful women of Georgia, the transfer of the country by its wali to the Russian Catherine II, placed in the commanding centre of Western Asia. Futteh Ali almost immediately found himself the object of eager competition by the representatives of the Christian powers at Tehran. His revenue was estimated by so competent an authority as Sir John Malcolm at nearly 6 million sterling, which was a lot of money in those days. The crown jewels, chief of them the Sea of Light, or Deri-i-Noor, a diamond weighing 178 carats, were then the most valuable collection in the world. For though Koh-i-Noor had remained with the Afghans, whence through the Sikhs it came to a greater Shah-in-Shah, the Queen Empress of Great Britain, he still possessed not a little of Nadir's plunder of Delhi. Sir Robert Kerr Porter describes him about the time when Martin reached his capital as one blaze of jewels at the New Year festival of Nowruz. On his head was a lofty tiara of three elevations, entirely composed of thickly set diamonds, pearls, rubies and emeralds, so exquisitely disposed as to form a mixture of the most beautiful colours in the brilliant light reflected from its surface. Several black feathers, like the heron plume, were intermixed with the resplendent aigrettes of this truly imperial diadem, whose bending points were furnished with pear-formed pearls of an immense size. The vesture was of gold tissue, nearly covered with a similar disposition of jewellery. And crossing the shoulders were two strings of pearls, probably the largest in the world. But for splendour, nothing could exceed the broad bracelets round his arms and the belt which encircled his waist. They actually blazed like fire when the rays of sun met them. The throne was of pure gold, white marble, raised a few steps from the ground, and carpeted with shawls and cloth of gold. While the great king was approaching his throne, the whole assembly continued bowing their heads to the ground till he had taken his place. In the midst of solemn stillness, while all eyes were fixed on the bright object before them, which sat indeed as radiant and immovable as the image of Mithras itself, a sort of volley of words bursting at one impulse from the mouths of the mullahs and astrologers made me start and interrupted my gaze. This strange oratory was a kind of heraldic enumeration of the great king's titles, dominions, and glorious acts. There was a pause, and then His Majesty spoke. The effect was even more startling than the sudden bursting forth of the mullahs, for this was like a voice from the tombs, so deep, so hollow, and at the same time so penetratingly loud. That was the man to whose feet the French Emperor Napoleon and the Tsar Alexander, King George III, and the greatest Governor-General of the East India Company, the Marquess Wellesley, sent special embassies, the man from whom they sought secret treaties, lavishing on his courtiers more than royal gifts, to arrest the march of the Afghan invader, who a few years before had reached Lahore on his way to set up again at Delhi the House of Timur, and in order to foil the secret embassy sent by Napoleon, who had resolved to give England its death blow through India, a young Scotsman, Captain Malcolm, was deputed to Tehran in 1801, following up a native envoy who had been most successful just before. This soldier, diplomatist, who was afterwards to help Henry Martin to a very different success, bribed like a king, and returned with two treaties, political and commercial, but still more with the knowledge which fitted him to write his classic history and make his second embassage. For England failed to carry out the first so far as to help the Shah against Russia, and from that hour Persia has seen province after province overwhelmed by the wave from the north. Taking alarm a second time, just before and after the Peace of Tilsit, both the Crown and the Company appointed plenipotentiaries to Tehran. It was Lord Minto's wise policy to protect our Indian Empire by binding the Western frontier states in a chain of friendly alliance. Hence the Governor-General's four missions to Sindh, to Lahore, to Kabul, and again to Persia under Sir John Malcolm. Sir Harford Jones appeared as ambassador from the Crown after Malcolm had left Tehran, and took advantage of a change in the political situation to secure the preliminary treaty of 1809, which renewed the pledge of its predecessor to assist the Shah with troops or a subsidy if any European forces should invade his territories. In a modified form, this became the definitive treaty of March the 14th, 1812, further altered in that of 1814, to arrange which Sir Gore Ouseley was sent out, superseding both Malcolm and Jones. Sir Gore Ouseley became Henry Martin's friend. Commended by Sir John Malcolm to his personal friends among the Persians, and officially encouraged by the British plenipotentiary, the Bengal chaplains, seeking health, had all the facilities secured to him that were possible to pursue the God-given mission of the Apostle of Christ to the peoples of Persia and Arabia. It was God's hand working to give him resources to do the translation work that he would do. The strong and wise rule of Fateh Ali Shah kept Persia itself at peace, but he could not get the better of Russian intrigue and attack, even with the friendly offices of the British government. Up till Martin's arrival, these vast regions had been wrested from the Shah in Shah. Georgia, Mingrelia, Dagestan, Sherwan, Karabakh and Talysh. During his presence in the country, the negotiations with Russia were going on, which ended in 1813 in the Treaty of Gulistan, surrendering to the Tsar all that he had taken, and apparently stopping his advance by a line of demarcation. But as its exact direction had to be settled by commissioners, Russia has ever since continued steadily to strip Persia of its northern lands, and only the presence of the British Navy has kept it as yet out of the Persian Gulf. The more things change, the more they remain the same, I guess. Such were the historical and political conditions amid which the missionary chaplain of India became a resident in the cities and a traveller through the villages of Persia and Turkey at the age of 30. He went there as the friend of Malcolm Sahib, whose gracious dignity and lavish gifts had made him a hero among the officials and many of the people of Persia. He went with letters of introduction from the Governor-General of India and the Governor of Bombay to the new British ambassador, who had lived at Lucknow and must have known well of his work in the neighbouring station of Cawnpore. He went with the reputation of a man of God in the Oriental sense, and of a scholar who knew the sacred books of the Mohammedans and Christians alike, and who sought the good of the people. And so Martin's reputation went before him. The Armenian colonies at Calcutta and Bombay had commended him to the many members of their church in Persia. Bushir, or Abu Shah, at which he began his mission to Persia, is the port of that province of Fars from which the whole empire takes its name. Farsi is the language of Persia today. Its mixed Persian and Arab population, now numbering some 15,000, its insanitary position on a spit of sand almost surrounded by the sea, and the filthy narrow streets hardly redeemed by the Char Burj or citadel, and the British residency do not attract the visitor, and he soon learns that the humid heat of its climate in summer is more insupportable than that even of the Red Sea. From Reshir, close by, in the Anglo-Persian War of 1856-7, General Havelock shelled the town when he pitched the camp of the force to the south of its gate. Henry Martin was there in the worst season of May and June, when the thermometer rises to 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, and sometimes 106 degrees. He became the guest of an English merchant and his Armenian wife, and was received by the Armenians as a priest of great sanctity. His journal describes his receptions and daily occupations. 1811, May the 23rd. rode out with a party in the evening, or rather in the afternoon, for the heat of the sun made me ill. May the 24th. The governor called on us, also the Armenian priest. Received an answer from the ambassador, Sir George Ouseley, to a letter I sent him from Muscat. May the 25th. In the evening called with two captains, the resident and the captain of his guard, on the governor. In consequence of a letter I brought for him from General Malcolm, he was very particular in his attentions, seated me on his own seat, and then sat by my side apart from the rest. I observed that a Christian was not allowed to enter a mosque. He said, "No, do you wish to hear the prayers?" I said, "No, but the preaching, if there is any." He said there were no preachers except at Yezd. May the 26th, Sunday. The Europeans assembled for divine service, which was performed at the residence. I preached on 1 Corinthians 4:15, "For he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet," etc. In the evening I went, at the Padre's request, to the Armenian church. There was the same disagreeable succession of unmeaning ceremonies and noisy chants as at Bombay. I was introduced within the rails, and at the time of incense I was censed, as the Padre afterwards desired me to observe 4 times, whereas the laity have the honour done them but once. I asked the old man what was meant by burning incense. He said it was in imitation of the wise men of the East, who have offered incense to Christ. I told him, "Why then do you not offer myrrh and gold?" To this he made no reply. Walking afterwards with him by the seaside, I tried to get into a conversation suitable to our profession as ministers, speaking particularly of the importance of the charge entrusted to us. Nothing could be more vapid and mean than his remarks. May the 27th. Very ill from headache and overpowering sleepiness, arising, as I suppose, from a stroke of the sun. As often as I attempted to read, I fell asleep and awoke in weakness and pain. How easily may existence be embittered! Still, I will say, "Not my will, but thine be done." In the evening, a Jewish goldsmith called with a fine boy who read the Hebrew fluently. Grief has marked the countenance of the Eastern Jews in a way that makes them indescribably interesting. I could have wept while looking at them. O Lord, how long? Will thine anger burn for ever? Is not justice yet satisfied? We ought to pray for the Jewish people today and look for that day of their salvation which is coming. This afflicted people are as much oppressed in Persia as ever. Their women are not allowed to veil as all others are required to do. Hence, if there be one more than ordinarily beautiful, she is soon known, and a Khan or the king sends for her, makes her Mahometan, and puts her into the harem. As soon as he is tired, she is given to another, and then to another, till she becomes the property of the most menial servant. Such is the degradation to which the daughters of Israel are subjected. Terrible. May the 28th. Through the infinite and unmerited goodness of God, I am again restored and able to do something in the way of reading. The resident gave us some account of this evening of the moral state of Persia. It is enough to make one shudder. If God rained down fire upon Sodom and Gomorrah, how is it that this nation is not blotted out from under heaven? I do not remember to have heard such things of the Hindus except the Sikhs. They seem to rival the Mahometans. For personal comfort and freedom from insult or attack, Henry Martin, when in Bushire, ordered the usual wardrobe of a Persian gentleman. He had suffered his beard and mustachios to vegetate undisturbed since leaving India. As he wrote to Corrie, "In conical astrakhan cap, baggy blue trousers, red boots, and light chintz tunic and choga, or flowing coat, mounted on a riding pony and followed by his Armenian servant on a mule, with another mule for his baggage, he set out on May the 30th, 1811, for Shiraz. His companion was a British officer. The party formed a large caravan with some 30 horses and mules carrying goods to the ambassador. They marched by night in the comparative coolness of 100 degrees Fahrenheit, to which the thermometer fell from the noonday heat of 126 degrees Fahrenheit. when they lay panting in their tents, protected from the scorching dry wind by heavy clothing. The journey of some 170 miles occupied the first 9 days of June. After 90 miles over a hot, sandy plain, the traveller rises by 4 rocky kotals or inclines, so steep as to be called ladders, over the spurs of the Zagros Range into a cooler region at Kazirun, on the central plateau of Iran, and then passes through the most delightful valleys, wooded or clad with verdure, to the capital, Shiraz, surrounded by gardens and by cemeteries. May the 30th. Our Persian dresses being ready, we set off this evening for Shiraz. Our kafila consisted of about 30 horses and mules, some carrying things to the ambassador, the rest for our servants and luggage. The animal for my use was a yabu, or riding pony, a mule for my trunks, and one for my servant Zachariah, an Armenian of Isfahan. It was a fine moonlight night, about 10 o'clock, when we reached out of the gate of Bushehr and began to make our way over the plain. Mr. B, who accompanied me a little way, soon returned. Captain T went on, intending to accompany us to Shiraz. This was the first time we had any of us put off the European, and the novelty of our situation... Sorry, I was distracted for a second there, so I'll just go back and read this. This was the first time any of us had put off the European, and the novelty of our situation supplied us with many subjects for conversation for about 2 hours. When we began to flag and grow sleepy, and the kafila was pretty quiet, one of the muleteers on foot began to sing. He sang with a voice so plaintive that it was impossible not to have one's attention arrested. At the end of the first tune he paused, and nothing was heard but the tinkling of the bells attached to the necks of the mules. Every voice was hushed. The first line was enough for me, and I dare say it set many others thinking of their absent friends. Without thee my heart can attach itself to none. It is what I have often felt on setting out on a journey. The friends left behind so absorb the thoughts that the things by the wayside are seen without interest, and the conversation of strangers is insipid. But perhaps the first line, as well as the rest, is only a promise of fidelity, though I did not take it in that sense when I first heard it. The following is perhaps the true translation. I was distracted again. So this is the translation of the song. Think not that e'er my heart can dwell contented far from thee. How can the fresh-caught nightingale enjoy tranquility? Forsake not then thy friend for aught that slanderous tongues can say. The heart that fixes where it ought no power can rend away. Thus we went on, and as often as the kafila by their dullness and sleepiness seemed to require it, or perhaps to keep himself awake, he entertained the company and himself with a song. We met two or three other kafilas taking advantage of the night to get on. My loquacious servant Zachary took care to ask everyone whence they came, and by that means sometimes got an answer which raised a laugh against him. June the 1st. At sunrise we came to our ground at Hameda, 6 parasangs, and pitched our little tent under a tree. It was the only shelter we could get. At first the heat was not greater than we had felt in India, but it soon became so intense as to be quite alarming. When the thermometer was above 112 degrees, fever heat, I began to lose my strength fast. At last it became quite intolerable. I wrapped myself up in a blanket and all the warm covering I could get to defend myself from the external air, by which means the moisture was kept a little longer upon the body and not so speedily evaporated as when the skin was exposed. One of my companions followed by my example and found the benefit of it, but the thermometer still rising and the moisture of the body being quite exhausted, I grew restless and thought I should have lost my senses. The thermometer at last stood at 126 degrees. In this state I composed myself and concluded that though I might hold out a day or two, death was inevitable. Captain T, who sat it out, continued to tell the hour and the height of the thermometer, And with what pleasure did we hear of its sinking to 120 degrees, 118 degrees, etc. Last the fierce sun retired, and I crept out more dead than alive. This is the price for preaching the gospel. It was then a difficulty how I could proceed on my journey, for besides the immediate effects of the heat, I had no opportunity of making up for the last night's want of sleep, and had eaten nothing. However, while they were loading the mules, I got an hour's sleep and set out, the muleteers leading my horse, and Zechariah my servant, an Armenian of Isfahan, doing all in his power to encourage me. The cool air of the night restored me wonderfully, so that I arrived at our next munzil with no other derangement than that occasioned by want of sleep. Expecting another such day as the former, we began to make preparation the instant we arrived on the ground. I got a tutty made of the branches of the date tree, and a Persian peasant to water it. By this means the thermometer did not rise higher than 114 degrees. But what completely secured me from the heat was a large wet towel, which I wrapped around my head and body, muffling up the lower part in clothes. How could I but be grateful to a gracious providence for giving me so simple a defence against what I am persuaded would have destroyed my life that day? We took care not to go without nourishment, as we had done. The neighbouring village supplied us with curds and milk. At sunset, rising up to go out, a scorpion fell upon my clothes. Not seeing where it fell, I did not know what it was. But Captain T, pointing it out, gave the alarm, and I struck it off, and he killed it. The night before, we found a black scorpion in our tent. This made us rather uneasy, so that though the kafila did not start till midnight, we got no sleep, fearing we might be visited by another scorpion. June the 2nd. We arrived at the foot of the mountains, at a place where we seemed to have discovered one of nature's ulcers, a strong, suffocating smell of naphtha announced something more than ordinarily foul in the neighbourhood. We saw a river. What flowed in it, it seemed difficult to say, whether it were water or green oil. It scarcely moved, and the stones which it laved, it left off of a greyish colour, as if its foul touch had given them leprosy. Our place of encampment this day was a grove of date trees, where the atmosphere at sunrise was 10 times hotter than the ambient air. I threw myself down on the burning ground and slept. When the tent came up, I awoke, as usual, in a burning fever. All this day I had recourse to the wet towel, which kept me alive, but would allow of no sleep. It was a sorrowful Sabbath, but Captain T read a few hymns, in which I found great consolation. At 9 in the evening, we decamped. The ground and air were so insufferably hot that I could not travel without a wet towel round my face and neck. This night, for the first time, we began to ascend the mountains. The road often passed so close to the edge of the tremendous precipices that one false step of the horse would have plunged his rider into inevitable destruction. In such circumstances, I found it useless to attempt guiding the animal, and therefore gave him the rein. These poor animals are so used to journeys of this sort that they generally step sure. There was nothing to mark the road but the rocks being a little more worn in one place than in another. Sometimes my horse, which led the way, as being the muleteer's, stopped, as if to consider about the way. For myself, I could not guess, at such times, where the road lay, but he always found it. The sublime scenery would have impressed me much in other circumstances, but my sleepiness and fatigue rendered me insensible to everything around me. At last we emerged superus ad auras, not on the top of a mountain to go down again, but to a plain or upper world. At the pass, where a cleft in the mountain admitted us into the plain, was a station of riders. While they were examining the muleteers' passports, etc., time was given for the rest of the kafila to come up, and I got a little sleep for a few minutes. June the 4th. We rode briskly over the plain, breathing a purer air, and soon came in sight of a fair edifice built by the king of the country for the refreshment of pilgrims. In this caravanserai, we took our abode for the day. It was more calculated for Eastern than European travellers, having no means of keeping out the air and light. We found the thermometer at 110 degrees. At the passes, we met a man travelling down to Bushehr with a load of ice, which he willingly disposed of to us. The next night, we ascended another range of mountains and passed over a plain where the cold was so piercing that with all the clothes we could muster, we were shivering. At the end of this plain, we entered a dark valley contained by two ranges of hills converging one to another. The muleteer gave notice that he saw robbers. It proved to be a false alarm, but the place was fitted to be a retreat for robbers, there being on each side caves and fastnesses from which they might have killed every man of us. After ascending another mountain, we descended by a very long and circuitous route into an extensive valley where we were exposed to the sun till 8 o'clock. Whether from the sun or from continued want of sleep, I could not, on my arrival at Kazirun, compose myself to sleep. There seemed to be a fire within my head, my skin like a cinder, and the pulse violent. Through the day it was again too hot to sleep, though the place was occupied. The place occupied was a sort of summer house in a garden of cypress trees, exceedingly well fitted up with mats and coloured glass. Had the kafila gone on that night, I could not have accompanied it, but it halted there a day, by which means I got a sort of night's rest, though I awoke 20 times to dip my burning hand in water. Though Kazirun is the second greatest town in Fars, we could get nothing but bread, milk, and eggs, and those with difficulty. The governor, who is under great obligations to the English, heard of our arrival, but sent no message. June the 5th. At 10 we left Kazirun and ascended a mountain. We then descended from it on the other side into a beautiful valley, where the opening dawn discovered to us ripe fields of wheat and barley, with a green oak here and there in the midst of it. We were reminded of an autumnal morning in England, thermometer 62. June 6th. Halfway up the Pirgan mountain, we found a caravanserai. There being no village in the neighbourhood, we had brought supplies from Kazirun. My servant, Zachary, got a fall from his mule this morning, which much bruised him. He looked very sorrowful and had lost much of his garrulity. June the 7th. Left the caravanserai at 1 this morning and continued to ascend. The hours were permitted to rest. The mosquitoes had effectually prevented me from using, so that I never felt more miserable and disordered. The cold was very severe. For fear of falling off from sleep and numbness, I walked a good part of the way. We pitched our tent in the Vale of Dastarjan, near a crystal stream, on the banks of which we observed the clover and golden cup. The whole valley was one green field, in which large herds of cattle were browsing. The temperature was about that of spring in England. Here a few hours' sleep recovered me in some degree from the stupidity in which I had been for some days. I awoke with a light heart and said, "He knoweth our frame, and remembereth that we are but dust. He redeemeth our life from destruction, and crowneth us with loving kindness and tender mercies. He maketh us to lie down in the green pastures, and leadeth us beside the still waters. And when we leave this vale of tears, there is no more sorrow, nor sighing, nor any more pain. The sun shall not light upon thee, nor any heat, but the Lamb shall lead thee to living fountains of waters." June the 8th. Went on to a caravanserai, 3 parasangs, where we passed the day. At night set out upon our last march for Shiraz. Sleepiness, my old companion and enemy, again overtook me. I was in perpetual danger of falling off my horse, till at last I pushed on to a considerable distance beyond the kafila, planted my back against a wall, and slept I know not how long, till the good muleteer came up and gently waked me. June the 9th, Sunday. By daylight we found ourselves in the plain of Shiraz. We went to the halting place outside the walls of the city, but found it occupied. However, after some further delay, we were admitted with our servants into another, As for the kafila, we saw no more of it. The ambassador, Sir Gore Ouseley, was encamped near us. Sir William and Major Darcy and Dr. Sharp called on us, but I did not see the two first, being asleep at the time. In the evening we dined with His Excellency, who gave us a general invitation to his table, returned to our garden where we slept. June the 10th, went this morning to Jafar Ali Khan's, to whom we had letters from General Malcolm, and with whom we are to take up our abode. After the long and tedious ceremony of coffee and kalyans, that's pipes, breakfast made its appearance on two large trays, curry, pilaws, various sweets cooled with snow and perfumed with rose water, were served in great profusion in china plates and basins, a few wooden spoons beautifully carved. But being in a Persian dress and on the ground, I thought it high time to throw off the European, and so ate with my hands. After breakfast, Jafir took me to a summer house in his garden, where his brother-in-law met us for the purpose of conversation. I don't know why it's spelled like that. But from something I had thrown out at breakfast about Sabbat and accident, he was curious to know what were our opinions on these subjects. He then began to explain his own sentiments on Sufism, of which it appeared he was a passionate admirer. June the 11th, breakfasted at Aeneas with some of the embassy, and went with them afterwards to a glass house and pottery. Afterwards called on Mr. Moria, secretary to the embassy, Major Darcy and Sir W. Ouseley. Our host, Jafar Ali Khan, gave us a good deal of information this evening about this country and government. He used to sit for hours with the king at Tehran, telling him about India and the English. June the 12th, employed about journal, writing letters, reading Gulistan, but excessively indolent. In the morning I enjoyed such comfort in prayer. What a privilege to have a God to go to in such a place and in such company. To read and pray at leisure seemed like coming home after being long abroad. Psalm 89 was a rich repast to me. Why is it not always thus with me? At Shiraz, Henry Martin was in the very heart of old Persia, to which the eldest son of Shem had given his name. Elam, one of the greatest of the Shahs, Karim Khan, made Shiraz his capital instead of the not distant Persepolis, which also Martin visited. The founder of the present dynasty levelled its walls and desolated its gardens, but the city of the six gates still dominates the fine valley which no tyrant could destroy, and has still a pleasing appearance, though its Diwan Khana has been stripped of the royal pillars to adorn the palace of the new capital of Tehran. Even Timur respected Shiraz when, red with the blood of Isfahan, he sent for Hafiz and asked how the poet dared to dispose of the Tartars' richest cities, Bukhara and Samarkand, for the mole on his lady's cheek. "Can the gifts of Hafiz ever impoverish Timur?" was the answer, and Shiraz was spared. Karim Khan long after built mausoleums over the dust of the Anacreon of Persia, and over that of Sa'di, its Socrates in verse, as Sir Robert Kerr Porter well describes, the author of the Gulistan, which was Martin's daily companion at this time. We have an account of Shiraz and the people of Persia, written 6 years before Martin's visit by Edward Scott Waring, Esquire, of the Bengal Civil Establishment, who, led by ill health and curiosity, followed the same route by Bushir and Kazirun to the city. He is sceptical as to those splendours which formed the theme of Hafiz, and describes the city as worth seeing but not worth going to see. The tomb of the prophet, the Hafizier garden, he found to be of white marble, on which two of his odes were very beautifully cut. A few dervishes daily visited the spot and chanted his verses. Mr. George N. Curzon, MP, the latest visitor, contrasts the grave of Hafiz with that of his contemporary Dante at Ravenna. Sa'di's grave was then quite neglected, No one had carved on it the beautiful epitaph paraphrased by Dryden, which he wrote for himself on the Bostan. O passenger who walkest over my grave, think of the virtuous persons who have gone before me. What has Sadi to apprehend from being turned into dust? He was but earth when alive. He will not continue dust long, for the winds will scatter him over the whole universe. Yet as long as the garden of knowledge has blossomed, not a nightingale has warbled so sweetly in it. It would be strange if such a nightingale should die and not a rose grow upon its grave. Sir Robert Kerr Porter, 12 years later, found both spots alike neglected. One poet had written of the garden where Hafiz was buried, "Paradise does not boast such lovely banks as those of Rock Nabil, nor such groves as the high-scented fragrance of the bowers of Masella." Another now sadly writes, "Though the bowers of love grew on its banks, and the sweet song of Hafiz kept time with the nightingale and the rose, the summer is past and all things are changed." 6 years after Henry Martin's residence in Shiraz, Sir Robert Kerr Porter entered the city which to him, as to every Christian or even English-speaking man, became thenceforth more identified with this century's apostle to the Persians than with even Hafiz and Sadi. "Faint with sickness and fatigue," he writes, "I felt a momentary reviving pleasure in the sight of a hospitable city and the cheerful beauty of the view. As I drew near, the image of my exemplary countryman, Henry Martin, rose in my thoughts, seeming to sanctify the shelter to which I was hastening." He had approached Shiraz much about the same season of the year, AD 1811, and like myself, was gasping for life under the double pressure of an inward fire and outward burning sun. He dwelt there nearly a year, and on leaving its walls, the apostle of Christianity found no cause for shaking off the dust of his feet against the Mohammedan city. The inhabitants had received, cherished, and listened to him, and he departed thence amidst the blessings and tears of many a Persian friend. Through his means, the gospel had then found its way into Persia. I believe there are many Christians in Iran today. And as it appears to have been sown in kindly hearts, the gradual effect hereafter may be like the harvest to the seedling. But whatever be the issue, the liberality with which his doctrines were permitted to have been discussed, and the hospitality with which their promulgation was received by the learned, the nobles, and persons of all ranks, cannot but reflect lasting honour on the government and command our respect for the people at large. Besides, to a person who thinks at all on these subjects, the circumstances of the first correct Persian translation of the Holy Scriptures being made at Shiraz and thence put into the royal hands and disseminated through the empire cannot but give an almost prophetic emphasis to the transaction as arising from the very native country, Persia proper, of the founder of the empire who first bade the Temple of Jerusalem be rebuilt, Cyrus, who returned her sons from captivity and who was called by name to the divine commission. As the guest of Jafar Ali Khan, now in his house in Shiraz, and now in his orange summer garden, Henry Martin gave himself up to the two absorbing duties of making a new translation of the New Testament into Persian, assisted by his host's brother-in-law, Mirza Sayyad Ali Khan, and of receiving, and in the Pauline sense, disputing with the learned Mohammedans of the city and neighbourhood. One thinks of Paul in Athens, for example. But all through his inner life, sanctified by his spiritual experience and intensifying that, there continued to run the love of Lydia Grenfell. To Lydia Grenfell, Martin writes, Shiraz, June 23rd, 1811. How continually I think of you and indeed converse with you, it is impossible to say, but on the Lord's Day in particular, I find you much in my thoughts, because it is on that day that I look abroad and take a view of the universal church, of which I observe that the saints in England form the most conspicuous part. On that day, too, I indulge myself with a view of the past and look over again those happy days when in company with those I loved. I went up to the house of God with a voice of praise. How then should I fail to remember her who, of all that are dear to me, is the dearest? 'Tis true that I cannot look back upon many days, nor even many hours passed with you. Would they have been more? But we have insensibly become more acquainted with each other, so that on my part at least it may be said that separation has brought us nearer to one another. It was a momentary interview, but the love is lasting and everlasting. Whether we ever meet again or not, I am sure that you will continue to feel an interest in all that befalls me. After the death of my dear sister, you bid me consider that I had one sister left while you remained, and you cannot imagine how consolatory to my mind this assurance is. To know that there is one who is willing to think of me and has leisure to do so is soothing to a degree that none can know but those who have, like me, lost all their relations. I sent you a letter from Muscat in Arabia, which I hope you received. For if not, report will again erase my name from the catalogue of the living, as I sent no other to Europe. Let me here say with praise to our ever-gracious Heavenly Father that I am in perfect health. Of my spirits I cannot say much. I fancy they would be better were the beloved Persis by my side. This name, which I once gave you, occurs to me at this moment, I suppose, because I am in Persia, entrenched in one of its valleys, separated from Indian friends by chains of mountains and a roaring sea, among a people depraved beyond all belief in the power of a tyrant guilty of every species of atrocity. Imagine a pale person seated on a Persian carpet, in a room without table or chair, with a pair of formidable mustachios and habited as a Persian, and you see me. June the 26th. Here I expect to remain 6 months. The reason is this. I found on my arrival here that our attempts at Persian translation in India were good for nothing. At the same time, they proposed, with my assistance, to make a new translation. It was an offer I could not refuse, as they speak the purest dialect of the Persian. My host is a man of rank, his name Jafir Ali Khan, who tries to make the period of my captivity as agreeable as possible. His wife, he has but one, never appears. Parties of young ladies come to see her, but though they stay days in the house, he dare not go into the room where they are. Without intending a compliment to your sex, I must say that the society here, from the exclusion of females, is as dull as it can well be. Perhaps, however, to a stranger like myself, the most social circles would be insipid. I am visited by all the great and the learned. The former come out of respect to my country, the latter to my profession. The conversation with the latter is always upon religion, and it would be strange indeed if the armour of truth on the right hand and on the left, I were not able to combat with success the upholders of such a system of absurdity and sin. As the Persians are a far more unprejudiced and inquisitive people than the Indians, and do not stand quite so much in awe of an Englishman as the timid natives of Hindustan, I hope they will learn something from me. The hope of this reconciles me to the necessity imposed on me of staying here. About the translation, I dare not be sanguine. The prevailing opinion concerning me is that I have repaired to Shiraz in order to become a Musulman. Others, more sagacious, say that I shall bring from India some more under pretence of making them Musulmans. But in reality, to seize the place, they do not seem to have thought of my wish to have them converted to my religion. They have been so long accustomed to remain without proselytes to their own. I shall probably have very little to write about for some months to come, and therefore I reserve the extracts of my journal, since I last wrote to you, for some other opportunity. Besides that, the ambassador with whose dispatches this will go is just leaving Shiraz. July the 2nd. The Mohammedans now come in such numbers to visit me that I am obliged, for the sake of my translation work, to decline seeing them. Today, one of the apostate sons of Israel was brought by a party of them to prove the divine mission of Muhammad from the Hebrew scriptures, but with all his sophistry, he proved nothing. I can almost say, with St. Paul, I feel continual pity in my heart for them, and love them for their father's sake, and find a pleasure in praying for them. While speaking of the return of the Jews to Jerusalem, I observed that the gospel that was then, this is 1967 when it actually happened, that the gospel of the kingdom must first be preached in all the world, and then shall the end come. He replied with a sneer, "And this event, I suppose you mean to say, is beginning to take place by your bringing the gospel to Persia." July the 5th. I am so incessantly occupied with visitors and my work that I have hardly a moment for myself. I have more and more reason to rejoice at my being sent here. There is such an extraordinary stir about religion throughout the city that some good must come of it. I sometimes sigh for a little Christian communion, yet even from these Mohammedans I hear remarks that do me good. Today, for instance, my assistant observed how he loved those 12 persons. "Yes," said I, "and not those 12 only, but all those who shall believe in him. As he said, I pray not for them alone, but for all them who shall believe on me through their word." Even the enemy is constrained to wonder at the love of Christ. Shall not the object of it say, "What manner of love is this? I have learned that I may get letters from England much sooner than by way of India. Be so good as to direct to me to the care of Sir Gore Ouseley, Bart, ambassador at Tehran, care of J. Morier, Esquire, Constantinople, care of G. Moon, Esquire, Malta. I have seen Europe newspapers of only 4 months' date, so that I am delightfully near you. May we live near one another in the unity of the Spirit, having one Lord, one hope, one God and Father. In your prayers for me, pray that utterance may be given me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mysteries of the gospel. I often envy my Persian hearers the freedom and eloquence with which they speak to me. Were I but possessed of their powers, I sometimes think that I should win them all. But the work is God's, and the faith of his people does not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Remember me as usual, with the most unfeigned affection, to all my dear friends. This is now the 7th letter I send you, without having received an answer. Farewell. Yours ever most affectionately, H. Martin. Shiraz, September the 8th, 1811. A courier on his way to the capital affords me the unexpected pleasure of addressing my most beloved friend. It is now 6 months since I left India, and in all that time I have not heard from thence. The dear friends there, happy in each other's society, do not enough call to mind my forlorn condition. Here I am still beset by cavilling infidels, and making very little progress in my translation, and half disposed to give it up and come away. My kind host, to relieve the tedium of being always within a walled town, pitched a tent for me in a garden a little distance, and there I lived amidst clusters of grapes by the side of a clear stream, but nothing compensates for the loss of the excellent of the earth. It is my business, however, as you will say, and ought to be my effort to make saints where I cannot find them. I do use the means in a certain way, but frigid reasoning with men of perverse minds seldom brings men to Christ. However, as they require it, I reason and accordingly challenge them to prove the divine mission of their prophet. In consequence of this, a learned Arabic treatise was written by one who was considered as the most able man, and put into my hands. Copies of it were also given to the college and the learned. The writer of it said that if I could give a satisfactory answer to it, he would become a Christian, and at all events would make my reply as public as I pleased. I did answer it, and after some faint efforts on his part to defend himself, he acknowledged the force of my arguments, but was afraid to let them be generally known. He then began to inquire about the gospel, praise God, but was not satisfied with my statement. He required me to prove from the very beginning the divine mission of Moses, as well as of Christ, the truth of the scriptures. With very little hope that any good will come of it, I am now employed in drawing out the evidences of the truth. But oh, that I could converse and reason and plead with power from on high! How powerless are the best directed arguments till the Holy Ghost renders them effectual! A few days ago I was just on the eve of my departure for Isfahan, as I thought, and my translator had consented to accompany me as far as Baghdad. But just as we were setting out, news came that the Persians and Turks were fighting thereabouts, and that the road was in consequence impassable. I do not know what the Lord's purpose may be in keeping me here, but I trust it will be for the furtherance of the gospel of Christ, and in that belief I abide contentedly. My last letter to you was dated July. I desired you to direct me at Tehran, as it is uncertain whether I shall pass anywhere near there. You had better direct to the care of S. Moria Esquire, Constantinople, and I can easily get your letters from thence. I am happy to say that I am quite well, indeed, never better, no returns of pain in the chest since I left India. May I soon receive the welcome news that you also are well and prospering, even as your soul prospers. Excuse me. Your letters, I read your letters incessantly and try to find out something new, as I generally do. But I begin to look with pain at the distant date of the last. I cannot tell what to think, but I cast all my care upon him who hath already done wonders for me, and am sure that come what will, it shall be good, it shall be best. How sweet the privilege that we may lie as little children before him. I find that my wisdom is folly and my care useless, so that I try to live on from day to day, happy in his love and care. May that God who hath loved us and given us everlasting consolation and good hope, through grace, bless, love, and keep my ever dearest friend, and dwelling in the secret place of the Most High, and abiding under the shadow of the Almighty, may she enjoy that sweet tranquillity which the world cannot disturb. Dearest Lydia, pray for me and believe me to be ever your most faithfully and affectionately yours, H. Martin. Shiraz, October the 21st, 1811. 'Tis, I think, about a month since I wrote to you, and so little has occurred since that I find scarcely anything in my journal, and nothing worth transcribing. This state of inactivity is becoming very irksome to me. I cannot get these Persians to work, and while they are idle, I am sitting here to no purpose. Sabbat's laziness used to provoke me excessively, but Persians, I find, are as torpid as Arabs when their salary does not depend on their exertions, and both very inferior to the feeble Indian, whom they affect to despise. My translator comes about sunrise, corrects a little and is off, and I see no more of him for the day. Meanwhile, I sit fretting, or should do so, as I did at first, were it not for a blessed employment which so beguiles the tediousness of the day that I hardly perceive it passing. 'Tis the study of the Psalms in the Hebrew. I have long had it in contemplation, in the assurance, from the number of flat and obscure passages that occur in the translations, that the original has not been hitherto perfectly understood. I am delighted to find that many of the most unmeaning verses in the version turn out, on close examination, to contain a direct reference to the Lord, our Saviour. The testimony of Jesus is indeed the spirit of prophecy. He is never lost sight of. Let them touch what subject they will, they must always let fall something about him. Such should be we should be looking always to him. I have often attempted the 84th Psalm, endeared to me on many accounts, as you know, but have not yet succeeded. The glorious 16th Psalm I hope I have mastered. I write with the ardour of a student communicating his discoveries and describing his difficulties to a fellow student. I think of you incessantly, too much, I fear, sometimes, yet the recollection of you is generally attended with an exercise of resignation to his will. In prayer I often feel what you described 5 years ago as having felt, a particular pleasure in viewing you as with me before the Lord and entreating our common Father to bless both his children. When I sit and muse, my spirit flies away to you and attends you at Girlin, Penzance, Plymouth Dock, and sometimes with your brother in London. If you acknowledge a kindred feeling still, we are not separated. Our spirits have met and blended. I still continue without intelligence from India. Since last January I have heard nothing of any one person whom I love. My consolation is that the Lord has you all under his care, and is carrying on his work in the world by your means, and that when I emerge I shall find that some progress is made in India, especially the country I now regard as my own. Persia is in many respects a ripe field for the harvest. Vast numbers secretly hate and despise the superstition imposed on them, and as many of them as have heard the gospel approve it, but they dare not hazard their lives for the name of the Lord Jesus. I am sometimes asked whether the external appearance of Mohammedanism might not be retained with Christianity, and whether I could be baptized, could not baptize them without their believing in the divinity of Christ. I tell them no. Though I have complained above of the inactivity of my translation, I have reason to bless the Lord that he thus supplies Gibeonites for the help of his true Israel. They are employed in a work of the importance of which they are unconscious, and are making provision for future Persian saints, whose time is, I suppose, now near. Roll back, ye crowded years, your thick array. Let the long, long period of darkness and sin at last give way to the brighter hours of light and liberty, which wait on the wings of the Son of Righteousness. Perhaps we witness the dawn of the day of glory, and if not, the desire that we feel that Jesus may be glorified and the nations acknowledge his sway is the earnest of the Spirit, that when we shall appear, we shall also appear with him in glory. Kind love to all the saints who are with his, waiting his coming. Yours with true affection, my ever dearest Lydia, Henry Martin. It is now determined that we leave Shiraz in a week, and as the road through Persia is impassable through the commotions which are always disturbing some part or other of this unhappy country, I must go back to Bushire. My scribe finished the New Testament in correcting. We are no further than the 13th of Acts. October the 24th to 26th. Resumed my Hebrew studies on the two first days, translated the 8 first Psalms into Persian, the last all day long, thinking about the word Higeon in the 9th Psalm. October the 27th to 29. Finished Psalm 12, reading the 5th of St. Matthew to Zechariah, my servant. Felt awfully convicted of guilt. How fearlessly do I give way to causeless anger, speaking contemptuously of men, as if I had never read this chapter. The Lord deliver me from all my wickedness, and write his holy law upon my heart, that I may walk circumspectly before him all the remaining days of my life. November the 1st. Everything was prepared for our journey to Baghdad by the Persian Gulf, and a large party of Shiraz ladies, chiefly of Mirza Said Ali's family, had determined to accompany us, partly from a wish to visit the tombs and partly to have the company of their relations a little longer. But a letter arriving with the intelligence that Baghdad was all in confusion, our kafila separated, and I resolved to go on through Persia to Armenia and so to Syria. But the season was too far advanced for me to think of traversing the regions of Caucasus just then, so I made up my mind to winter at Shiraz. That's the end of chapter 9. What incredible things men went through to preach the gospel. David just got on a plane, take a taxi. Work would still be hard. The main work being obviously to, in this case, translate the Bible and to disseminate the gospel and prayer. But those journeys, boy, I don't think I could survive one of those. But if we're going to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have to be determined. And that determination comes from God.